you have to trust yourself. You have to trust your own gut. I was talking with my brother, Wally, who I'm very adore my brother. He's been his success. Wally Bryce has been very successful in his career. And he said, you know, as we get older, we have to trust our passion. We have to, we can really follow our passion. And that really spoke to me because I thought he was going to say, you know, you have to be really sober and be really rational. And he said, no, you got to follow your heart. And so I think that that's it, you know, and that spoke to me as well.
The oil and gas industry, the driving engine of the world economy, delivering prosperity, innovation, and abundance across the globe. Here are the stories of its key players, directly from the leaders themselves. This is Oil and Gas Industry Leaders Podcast, where real experiences are passed on from the leaders of today to the leaders of tomorrow. Here is your host, Paige Wilson.
Welcome back to another episode of Oil and Gas Industry Leaders Podcast. If you're interested in getting your hands on some OGGN swag, we have a merch store still. In fact, if you order an Industry Leaders t-shirt, send me a picture of you wearing it. We'll tag you on any of our social and give you a shout out on the show. While you're doing that, sign up for our Sunday update. There's some behind the scenes moments with the OGGN team and exclusive perks to check out that shows up in your inbox every single week. Okay, well, let's just get into it. I'm sitting here today with Robert Bryce, author, host of the Power Hungry podcast, and producer of just newly released five-part docuseries called Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid. Welcome to the show, Robert. Let's talk about how you got started in the industry.
Sure. I've been a reporter my whole career, so I don't consider myself part of the energy sector at all. I consider myself, I guess, in the media, but I've been in journalism, never had a real job, been a reporter my whole career. So now 30 some odd years, almost 35 years, in fact, getting paid to do what I do. How did I get started and why do I write about energy? I would say that in the 90s, I was writing for a number of publications and I realized, you know, I started writing more about energy and I guess energy really part of my upbringing. I grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which for a while was known as the oil capital of the world. That maybe about 20 minutes or so, maybe in the 1930s. That's now clearly Houston, Texas. But the more I wrote as a journalist, more I covered the energy and power sectors, the more I realized, well, this is the most important business in the world. Every other business depends on the energy and power. And so whatever happens in energy and power affects everyone. And so that led me to my first book on Enron, which now came out now 22 years ago. And then, you know, I've published five books since then and just seems like one thing has led to another. And here I am more than 30 years into it. And I'm just completely captivated by energy and power and consider myself incredibly lucky to be able to write about, think about, talk about these issues.
Yeah. And you're incredibly credible. Just, I got to sit down the other night and go through these and it's a really a great docuseries. Would you like to talk more about it?
Oh, if I must, Paige. Yes, as you kindly noted, it's a new five-part docuseries called Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid. It's available for free. JuiceTheSeries.com. Did I mention JuiceTheSeries.com, Paige? I think I knew meant to mention JuiceTheSeries.com is where you will find all five episodes. We're giving them away. They're for free. You can find them on YouTube. I'm really proud of this project. I've worked on it for now more than 3 years with my colleague, Tyson Culver. He directed. I'm a co-producer. He did a great job putting it all together. The look, the animations, the sequencing, the editing, the music. We have an original score, original animations. We have more than 30 on-camera interviews with some of the top thought leaders in the world on the power sector and why, you know, our grid is being weakened. But just the capsule, why did we make the project? Well, I live in Austin, Texas, and we got blacked out. My wife, Lauren, and I got blacked out here during Winter Storm Uri for 48 hours. Tyson got blacked out as well. And in the wake of that, we heard, you know, we learned, well, oh, well, by the way, the ERCOT grid nearly collapsed. And if that had happened, of course, tens of thousands of people would have died. And the more we looked at it, the more we realized, well, the grid all over the country is being weakened. What's going on here? So we made this film or this series to underscore the importance of the electric grid, why it's being fragilized and what we need to do to fix it. And so it's not a partisan project. It's not one that leans left or right. It's, I think, very fact filled. And I think, well, I'm really proud of it. I mean, I think it's terrific and can't recommend it highly enough. We've had very good reviews and good traction on YouTube, and we want to change the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you explain a little further of how our grid has been fragilized?
Sure. And the way I would be, you know, the quickest way to think about it is, if we're facing climate change and it's serious about, you know, if we're serious about making our electric grid more resistant to hotter weather, colder weather, more extremes, longer extremes of weather, as we've seen over the past few years, hot summers, cold winters, right? We've always had that. But what's happening is we're adding more weather-dependent generation, solar and wind. And if we want to make the system more resilient, the last thing we should be doing is making it dependent on the weather. And yet that's exactly where all of the incentives are, not all of the incentives, but the financial incentives now are for building more solar and wind. We've had these massive federal projects, federal spending bills, the Inflation Reduction Act, et cetera, that are incenting the construction of solar and wind to the nearly the exclusion of everything else. And this is just bad policy. Now, we don't make it as partisan as that, as I'm saying it right here, but we're closing coal plants, we're closing nuclear plants, and this is the wrong direction. We need to have weather resilient systems, not weather dependent ones.
Right, because the weather always changes.
Absolutely. And if we're going to see more demand because of electric vehicles or heat pumps or whatever, we need that system to be ever more resilient and more robust. And instead, as we point out in the film, we've seen an increase in blackouts across the grid in the United States have increased 13-fold since 2000. So something is happening here. It's very obvious. And so we need to be paying attention.
Yeah. And it's kind of where it depends on where the money goes, right?
Well, it's always about the money.
Right. And that's really my point.
Yeah. And you see, what did Warren Buffett say in 2014? The only reason to build wind turbines is to collect the tax credits. I've written on my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. The DOE's own numbers show that the subsidies on a per unit of energy basis that are given out by the federal government for solar are 302 times more than those given to nuclear. So why aren't we building nuclear? Well, because that's not where the money is. You know, the famous bank robber, Willie Sutton, he was asked, he was in the 20s or 30s, he was asked by a reporter one time, well, why do you rob banks? And Willie Sutton said, that's where the money is. Why are we building?
Literally.
Why are so many entities building solar and wind? That's where the money is. Hello. You know, this is not, this isn't rocket surgery to, you know, use that old line.
Right. Yeah. So with all this, I did catch the very end of it. It went really hard into nuclear, and I'm a proponent for nuclear as well, because it is the safest way to go about it. What do you really want people to take away from this, other than just the nuclear part, just as a whole?
Sure. Well, what we're hoping to do, as I mentioned earlier, and Tyson Culver and I have had many conversations about this, we want to change people's understanding of what's going on. We want people to pay attention, right? That we take electricity for granted, but we ignore this electric network, our most important energy network, at our extreme peril. And we're seeing it fragilized. We're seeing it undermined. I'm pro natural gas, always have been. But we are in a situation now where we're making the grid too dependent on a single fuel, and that's bad for energy security. So we're closing coal plants, you know, we're closing nuclear plants. And in doing so, we're making the entire grid more dependent on natural gas. And NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, has pointed this out. And I've written about this on my Substack. They're pointing out that the electric grid and the natural gas grid are, what did they say, increasingly out of synchronism is their term, I think. So this is really critically important that we understand, and that's the motivation here. We're giving this film away, these docuseries, we're making it free. We want people to watch them. We want them to share them. So juicetheseries.com. Did I mention juicetheseries.com?
I think you did. And I think that's what I appreciate, kind of like what Carlson's doing, is you're going out there and you're going, here is the free information. Do with what you can and take from it and learn from it and educate yourself.
Well, exactly. And that's what, you know, this is, you know, in thinking about your podcast and what you're trying to do, you're talking to people who are in leadership positions in the energy sector. And I talk to a lot of different groups. I make my living as a public speaker. I don't have any other income. I give away my Substack. I give away my podcast, but I get paid to go around and talk to people about energy and power systems. I talk to a lot of cooperatives. I talk to people in the oil and gas industry. I talk to manufacturers. I talk to a wide variety of different groups. And the key is, I think, making people, you know, giving them metrics to understand what's going on. That's key, right? What are the numbers? What are the numbers? What are the numbers? And how do you make comparisons to make people understand what's going on? But we need to get that conversation ignited. We need to get people talking about it. We need to make them understand it. So we're aiming at the general audience and we're aiming at policymakers. We want to make them understand what's going on.
Yeah, because we all know the policymakers have no freaking idea.
Because they're lawyers. No and, why are they lawyers? Because they couldn't do the math to get into engineering school. I mean,
exactly.
It's just like, China is run by engineers. America is run by lawyers, And so, my brother was a lawyer, I know a lot of lawyers, right?
But I do too.
They don't understand the technical part of this. And so our grid and the policies and the rules that are being promulgated to manage the grid and this deregulation, which has been a real problem. And some of this is dates back to the Enron days. And that was my first book now 22 years ago. But this idea, we'll just deregulate it. And we'll just everybody will compete in the marketplace. Well, it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what the grid is and what electricity is. But, you have lawyers design the policies. Well, don't be surprised if it doesn't exactly work out.
Right, right. So you, Robert and Tyson, what are some of the real challenges that you two had making this docuseries?
Well, thank you. I mean, that's an interesting question. One of them was just trying to wrestle the subject to the ground, right? Because it's so big. And how do you talk about a network that has 6 million miles of wire and 13,000 power plants and, 800 cooperatives and all this other stuff? How do you shrink it down to make it manageable? And so one of the biggest challenges we had was just wrestling it to the ground and finally deciding, well, we shouldn't make an 80-minute feature-length film. Let's break it into 5 20-minute parts. And that's what we ended up doing. So in doing that, it meant that the project took longer to make. It cost more to produce. And so those were of all the friction points, that was the one where we had the most difficulty was just understanding what was the format that was going to work the best to help people break this down into more bite-sized chunks. And, frankly, we live in a TikTok world now, right? People want short-form content. And so that appealed to me because, I have the attention span of a fruit fly. So, I want things to be quick, right? And so we've been pleased by that. And I've had really good feedback even from some teachers saying, hey, we can show 20-minute episodes in class. This works perfectly for us. Whereas 80 minutes, that would be more difficult. So, and I appreciate that question. I haven't had that question before and hadn't really thought about it much, but all the usual friction of just trying to decide, well, which gets in, which gets out. But, trying to make the entire project come together in a way that was user-friendly. And I think we arrived on that in a really positive way.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I was also going to ask, was it difficult getting all these different leaders and different experts and such to come and speak on this?
Yes.
Right. I already knew the answer, but...
No, well, I mean, it was just that, I travel a lot for my speaking business. I did 38 engagements last year. I already have 20 on my calendar this year. I travel a lot. So that was, just getting to these different places and getting back and all the logistics. Of course, there's always friction in that, but 30 plus interviews, I think we have 34 ultimately, but some of them we did others that didn't make or didn't fit in what we were doing. So, there was, of course, friction and all of that, but we were very fortunate, in getting people to support our project and understand what we were doing. And so that was the other really positive thing and really humbling and flattering. Well, I won't say humbling. Nobody's ever accused me of being humble, but flattering and heartening that people would get behind us and talk to us.
Yeah, that's great. And so you've gotten a chance to, kind of lead in a way by doing all this, and you've met with all these different types of leaders. So let's kind of get into that leadership portion. What is leadership to you, Robert?
I like this question. I know we talked about it before we started, talking. And I think to me, it requires a certain amount of just fearlessness and that you've got to put away, you've got to tamp down the fear, ignore the fear, and just forge ahead because you have a vision for what you want to do. And, I talk about this with my children and, they're always critics. There's always people in the peanut gallery. And the peanut gallery is full of people who don't do anything except criticize, So in my own experience, what I've had to do in my own career, and I produce a lot of content, and I'm not bragging, it's just true. On my Substack, I produce a podcast a week. I produce short videos. I travel, I speak. You just have to shut off the noise. You have to ignore the idiots and you have to believe in your vision and pursue it like crazy. I mean, you just have to be single-minded about it and ignore the idiots, ignore the peanut gallery and keep going at what you originally aimed for. That I think is, I'm spitballing here a little bit, but that's what's coming to mind for myself. And I haven't worked my tail off. I've been working like a dog lately, but that's what I'm called to do. And so by God, I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And it's really hard to shut all of that out, as you were saying. You know, everybody's, you know, a warrior behind a keyboard.
If I can add one quick idea there, because there was a long time ago, I used to write for the Austin Chronicle newspaper. I live in Austin, Texas. It was the alternative weekly here in town, and it's been in business for a long time. And I remember vividly an interview that Lewis Black, the former editor, did with the writer of the first Batman movie named Warren Scarron. Lewis asked him about that creative process, about, you know, making it happen. And I remember Scarron, who died shortly thereafter of cancer, died early. He said, you know, you have to shoo away the black crow. And Lewis asked him, what do you mean? He said, well, I could sit there at the computer and there's a black crow that sits on my shoulder and looks at what I'm doing and says, oh, that stinks. You know, throw that out. Right. And he talked about the crow as an image, and you have to shoo the crow away. And so that just pops into my head, is this idea about, if you're going to try and if you're going to lead people, if you're going to lead yourself, if you're going to plunge into that position where there's a lot of uncertainty, you just have to believe, and you have to believe like crazy, and you have to keep shooing the crow away, because the crow will otherwise eat everything that you produce.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. What a great analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would be an example of a difficult time you've had it in some sort of leadership?
Oh, getting fired, you know, because what makes you doubt that more than anything, you know, doubt your own ability, you know, doubt your worth, then that kind of thing. But also, you know, just frankly, sometimes where you're, you know, well, I've been working at something and wondering, well, what does this, any of this really matter? Right. So I think that's common to everyone, though. You have those, you know, those doubts that keep coming up, and they increase when you have a setback. But in looking back, you know, getting fired was the best thing that ever happened in my, you know, in my recent career, because, man, it lit a fire under my ass. You know, I'm going to show those people, you know, I don't need you. I don't need your thing. I'll do it on my own. And that, I take a lot of pride in that now. You know, I own myself. And Oprah Winfrey had a great interview. This is years ago. She was talking about the ability, and it was actually in a profile, Tyler Perry, the incredibly prolific and successful filmmaker. And he went out on his own, and she's a friend of his. And she just said, you know, you have to own yourself. And she said, I remember it almost exactly. And when you do that, it will take you like whoosh, she said. And that was what I found, was that being on my own, being independent and producing my own content increased my credibility, made me more authentic and more powerful in the contest of ideas, because, you know, no one can say, oh, you work for them. No, I work for myself. And if you don't like it, piss off.
Yeah. Now, would you consider that the most rewarding thing about leadership?
Well, the most rewarding thing, you know, I think people have to kind of calibrate that themselves, right? About what that is. You know, there's a certain amount of fulfillment, like with this docuseries, juicetheseries.com. Did I mention juicetheseries.com?
No, I don't think you have. You should do it again.
juicetheseries.com. We got finished. And I think it must be like women, you know, when they have a baby. And my wife and I, Lauren, we've been incredibly happy and lucky in our 37 years, and we've had three children. I am assuming, I can only assume, that it's what women feel after childbirth, that you get to the end and you think, ah, I've done it. No, look at this. But then there's some letdown that happens after that as well. So that's natural, right? And I felt that intensely after that happened. It's taken me a while to kind of regain my footing and kind of, I mean, don't want to make too big a deal of it. It's not like I've fallen into some pit of despair or anything, but it was that constant recalibrating. Okay, well, that was an accomplishment. I have it out now, but now I got to sell it. And so that idea, the reward, yes, that product of the thing is rewarding to get the thing done. But you have to have, I think, in my own view, you have to like the process, you know, and that's why I write all the time. I'm writing all the time. But part of that is I like the process, that I'm figuring out the puzzle, right? And that is, I get reward out of that myself, that I make a graphic that's telling, that I can put on my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. I'm just doing one now on high voltage transmission and trying to, you know, comparisons on inflation rates in utility products and, you know, making it as clear as I can. And that alone to me is, that's fulfilling. I've done the best I can do, and I've got that one little thing that's good enough.
Yeah, I get that. I definitely get that. So if you had a piece of advice to give our audience, what would that be, Robert?
Ignore the idiots.
Right back to it.
Well, I mean, you have to ultimately, you know, I have friends and I consult with my friends and ask for advice sometimes and talk about where I'm at, where I am. I almost said where I'm at, which my late mother would say, no, don't end your sentences with a preposition. But, you know, to talk about something I'm facing, but ultimately you have to trust yourself. You have to trust your own gut. I was talking with my brother, Wally, who I'm very adore my brother. He's been his success. Wally Bryce has been very successful in his career. And he said, you know, as we get older, we have to trust our passion. We have to, we can really follow our passion. And that really spoke to me because I thought he was going to say, you know, you have to be really sober and be really rational. And he said, no, you got to follow your heart. And so I think that that's it, you know, and that spoke to me as well, because, you know, with this docuseries, I followed my heart. I was called to make this. And I think that's one of the reasons why we finally got it done was I was committed to this because I was in a unique position to do the project. And that was ultimately why I did it. And I think why I had success in getting the thing done was because I was all in.
What was the moment in which that occurred?
Well, it was now 3 years ago or more, or a little less than 3 years ago. And I was talking about this with a friend of mine and saying, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. And he said, well, I'll back you. And it's not someone I know necessarily very well, but he said, I'll back you. And I just thought how heartening that was. And it was like this, like getting a jump start on an engine or something. And it just this, he had enough faith in me to say, I'll get behind you. And I thought, okay, well, then I'm going to do it. And it was that moment where I just decided that one vote of confidence was enough to make me think, well, okay, there we go. Off we are.
It's always good to have good people around you like that.
And you'll have very few. I mean, my experience, I'm 63 and a half and I'm an old man, right? But what have I learned in my life? You'll have very few friends. I mean, really people that you can really count on.
I've learned that at 40. So
you'll meet a lot of people and you'll have a lot of acquaintances and a lot of colleagues. Don't mistake them for your friends. And you have to be very, very careful about that because these people will disappoint you and you have to be very ready for that. But there are people that you know, when you can count on, it doesn't have to be a large number, but that you know are behind you. It's an incredible source of power.
Yeah, no, I feel that inside and out. Yeah, been very lucky. What book has influenced you as an author? Which book has influenced you?
Well, this isn't an energy or power book, but I love Mark Twain. His book, Joan of Arc, is one of the best books ever written, I think. And Twain's ability with the word is just, you know, his ability to be funny on the page.
Oh, he's such a great author.
Just so impressive to me. I'm reading Richard Rhodes' biography of John James Audubon right now. His ability to weave all these different stories together. I'm a longtime bird watcher, lifelong bird watcher, which is one of the many reasons why I'm a longtime critic of the wind business.
Yeah, that's understandable.
They don't like me and I don't like them back, which is just fine. But Rhodes is an amazing author. So I would say one of my favorite books on energy and power is Vaclav Smil's book, Inventing the 20th Century. Just a marvel of Smil's, you know, he's a polymath, an incredibly productive writer. And he has this book about the inventions that occurred between the end of the Civil War and the start of the First World War. I think I'm getting that. I'm looking on my bookshelf to make sure I got the,
don't title, worry, everybody
the title
does it.
Right. But yeah, but that book, I think, is one of the ones that in terms of helping me understand invention and technology and just the, you know, the amount of information that he was able to synthesize. I mean, just truly impressive. So yeah, Creating the 20th Century, Technical Innovations of 1867 to 1914 and Their Lasting Impact. I could give you 5 or 10 more, but Mark Twain in general, Richard Rhodes in general. But if I were going to recommend one book on modern technology and energy, you know, auto cycle engines, telephones, automobiles, you know, electricity, Creating the 20th Century would be it.
Very good. Very good. What would you say is your most used business tool?
Well, I would say obviously the computer, right? You know, my laptop.
Yeah.
I don't know, pen and paper. I use legal pads. You know, I'm kind of old fashioned that way. I take comfort in making lists, pen, you know, writing a list with a pen.
I remember it better when I write it down.
Well, there's something satisfying about crossing the damn thing off too.
Yes.
So, you know, to me, I'm always trying to find that balance between the analog and the digital. And I find having those analog things that are, you know, and I have to have a certain kind of pen. And it's a Super Comfort gel ink pen with 0.7 millimeter black ink.
Yeah, I prefer felt tip pens.
Those are okay, but I like this. I like the way this glides. And so I buy them by the dozens. And so, you know, I get in my dotage, I'm more particular about the thingness of the things that I use. And so this is one of my predilections.
Very good. So who could you say is your most respected competitor?
Well, you know, I'm in journalism, so I don't necessarily think about competition. And I think about colleagues that I admire, the work that they do. Chris Kiefer, Dr. Chris Kiefer, he has the Decouple podcast. I really dig what he does. I really am a fan of his. And, you know, I don't necessarily view him as a competitor at all. I view him as a friend who I talk to, and, you know, I talked to him briefly today. My friend Emmett Penny, the editor of Grid Brief, I think, you know, sometimes, in fact, he wrote a piece just recently on Substack called Industrial Cathedrals, and I read it, and I thought, damn, I wish I'd written that. You know, it's like one of those things where, damn it, you know, and Emmett's 20 years younger than I am or so, a little more maybe, and he's educated in the classics. And so he doesn't have a background in energy and power, but now he's become a real expert on the electric grid and at its Grid Brief, gridbrief.com. And I recommend people subscribe to it. But, you know, I read sometimes the things he writes and I think, that is, and I don't use this word very often, erudite. You know, it's just brilliantly written and a brilliant insight. And the way he puts it together and this thought process, I think, man, that's good. You know, but it's the people whose work I admire and, you know, I don't say envy, but that I, you know, I wish sometimes I'd written because it's so good. I find them on Substack. I don't, you know, in the legacy media, zero, no reporters, none of them, you know, maybe Javier Blas at Bloomberg, you know, but he's not really a competitor. And, but, you know, he's a really sharp energy writer. But I find the number of people who write on energy and power who really know it and do it well, that number is very, very few.
Yeah, I agree with that. I will agree with that. I actually just had David Blackman on a few.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, he's great. So what would you say makes your documentary better than others in this space?
Well, I would say better than, there aren't many that have been done that focus on the grid. So, you know, what makes it better is there's so few.
Well, that's already what makes it better, right?
If there's no competition, I'm automatically the best. So I joke about my first doc, which was Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, which I made with Tyson. I made that one together as well. And when I give speeches, and I give a lot of them, I'd say, you know, this is the best documentary on electricity you'll ever see. And then I just shut up and I smile and the audience kind of titters a little bit and they laugh a little bit. And I said, well, it ain't bragging if you really done it. That's what Dizzy Dean said. And so, you know, what makes it better and what makes, I think, this new docuseries, in all seriousness, what makes it compelling is that it's not me explaining how everything works. We're going to people who are true experts on this, including Meredith Angwin, Dr. Chris Kiefer, Emmett Penny's in the film, you know, others, Jennifer Hernandez, who's done some great work on energy poverty in California, Robert Apodaca, many others, Maddie Hilly, talking about these issues in ways that are Ed Herr's, very cogent and explaining what's going on. So I think the strength of this project is that we have a diverse group of voices explaining in very simple ways, as simple as we need, you know, you can, simple ways about what's going on. So I think that's the strength of this project in particular, is that we're just not there yakking at the audience saying, listen to this. Instead, we're saying, here is the assembly of people, some of the best experts in the world. We're not just saying this, they're saying this. And so that, I think, is what is the power of the project, one of the many powers of the project. And in addition, as I said, Tyson just did a marvelous job in stitching it all together. And we're using some of the best high resolution cameras, 6K, 8K cameras you can buy, you know, and really made it look appealing.
Oh, it's very appealing. And in fact, as a podcaster, and I have to do all, you know, the music, the intro, I loved the intro music on this. It was fantastic.
Oh, yeah, that's the Greyhounds. It's an Austin band, the one that is in the introduction. The Greyhounds are from Austin here. So they have a new album coming out, and our co-producer and chief editor, Ted Powers, heard it. And he said, hey, you ought to listen to this. And that was, in fact, they agreed to let us license it. And it's just the perfect fit for what we, you know, the kind of drive that we wanted in that introduction.
Yeah, it made it sound powerful before you even got to hear the power behind it.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. What would you say is your most important lesson learned, Robert?
In my life or in the business, in the career? What are you talking about?
Pick of it. One. No, you can talk about all of it. We've got time.
Sure. Well, marry the right woman, I guess, if you're a guy.
You know, or a lesbian, you know, whatever.
Well,
float your boat.
Pick the right spouse. And I've been incredibly fortunate. You know, my wife, Lauren, has been incredibly supportive of my career. And she's an artist, a photographer, a master potter, and she's a teacher. She teaches at Laguna Gloria. She teaches ceramics at Laguna Gloria here in Austin. I'm just in all day proud of what she does. And so
that's awesome.
If you're going to succeed broadly in life. I mean, I know people who've made a lot of money, but they're not happy because they don't have the right partner. They don't have anybody to share it with. And I mean, these are some people I know who have made staggering amounts of money and, you know, they're okay, you know, but they don't have anyone. They lack a little of that joy in their life because there's not someone there to make them, you know, to really come home to and say, hey, you know, look at this. But that would be my first thing. And that's the part of, you know, the center of my life. And so I'd start there. And, you know, and my kids have, obviously, our children have given us great joy and, you know, often challenges, but that's part of the deal too. But I think that, you know, the other part is that I've been able to find work that is my purpose and my passion. And so, you know, I work hard, I work a lot, but I don't begrudge the work because it's what I feel I'm supposed to be doing.
Right. Yeah. I got to understand that. So how is your role now important to the future of the industry?
Well, I mean, that's a little, you know, egotistical to say, well, I'm important because
in this industry, it's such a big world, but it's a small world. So I feel like we all fit in our own piece into it.
Sure. What do I hope I'm accomplishing? One of my main goals is I want to speak for the people who aren't represented in Washington. And that, who is that? It's the people who build things, fix things, grow things. I want to speak for the people that have their names on their shirts and turn wrenches. I love those people. I mean, and I see them. I travel a lot in rural America, and I love those people. I meet them, and I was in Kearney, Nebraska. Was it early December or was it late November? I'm trying to remember. I've been a bunch of places since then. But I remember I had a presentation to the Nebraska Public Power Association in Kearney, Nebraska, and it was the same day that the meeting began in Dubai at COP28. And I got up on the podium and I said, you know, I'm in Kearney, Nebraska at the same time where, you know, the climate meeting is starting in Dubai. And I said, I don't know if it's possible to get further away from what's going on at COP28 in Dubai than in Kearney, Nebraska. And before I went on stage, I was talking to a manager, what's his name, Chet? Oh, what's Chet's last name? He runs a small public power entity in northeastern Nebraska, and they have feedlots and they grow corn. And, you know, he was telling me about their local businesses. And I thought, you know, he is so far removed from that, let's call it what it is, elite gathering of people talking about climate change. You know, yes, you could get further away geographically, but ideologically, kind of, you know, focus wise, it would be difficult to get further away. Right. So that's what I hope my contribution is in this broad, you know, big old goofy world, is that I want to bring attention to the affordability, resilience, and reliability of our energy and power systems, and that this is the basis of our society. And we ignore all that. We ignore, in particular, and that's one of the focal points of the docuseries, we ignore the importance of these networks at our extreme peril. And so that's my focus, and that's what I hope my contribution is.
Great, great. What are your thoughts about telling someone about this industry that doesn't understand the industry?
How long do we have, Paige?
We can do up to an hour. So,
well, where to start? I'd say, what do I promote, or what do I try, even in my presentations, often to energy audiences? And I'll get up there and I'll start explaining energy units, and in particular, exajoules, right? Because the Statistical Review of World Energy is now publishing their data in exajoules, not in quadrillion BTUs, not in million tons of oil equivalent. Those are imperial units, right? They're publishing them in SI units, in metric units. And even in rooms full of engineers, filled with engineers, hundreds of them. And I'll ask, who in the audience knows what an exajoule is? And there may be one or two or three hands. And then I start wagging my finger and I say, you need to know this. You can't call yourself an energy professional if you don't know your units. You have to know this. So it's my preface to, you know, what do I, you know, how do I, when I explain to people who are not in the industry why energy and power matters, well, first, you have to be able to make them understand some of the units that are involved, right? The scale of the industry, which is just almost beyond comprehension. It's just staggeringly large. But I think it's also, you know, if I were going to start with someone who's an absolute novice, or if I were speaking to my late mother, who was, you know, a very intelligent woman, but not an expert on any of this stuff, you know, I'd start by just saying, doesn't matter what you're talking about, you know, in your society and what you're dealing with, what you passes through your hands, what you eat, what you drink, what you wear, one way or another, there's energy involved in that. And nearly everything we touch, read, eat, or wear has been electrified in one way or another. So that this ultimately is, we take all of this for granted because we live in such energy abundance. And that's one of the problems that we face, is that so many people in our everyday life, particularly here in America, they don't think a thing about this. But energy poverty is rampant all over the world. And in fact, people die because of energy poverty in such a routine manner. In fact, many are burned to death. And I was just doing a short piece on that today because, you know, they're seeking to cadge a little free motor fuel and they, you know, won't go into that. But what do people need to understand? And the first thing is, well, you need to understand how big this industry is and how important it is to everything you do. And you take it for granted, but you take it for granted because you live in extreme energy abundance. And that doesn't mean it's always going to be there.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. So do you have a favorite podcast?
That would be the Power Hungry Podcast. The host is me, the Power Hungry Podcast. I listened to Chris. I was just talking to Chris Kiefer. In fact, I listened to his podcast, Decouple. I listened to Jordan Peterson's podcast. I've been on Jordan Peterson's podcast once.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I don't listen, you know, frankly, Paige, I'm so busy doing what my own thing is. I don't have much time to put other people's podcasts in my ears. It's like, and once I get, you know, time to walk around Town Lake here in Austin or something, I don't want to listen to anything. I just want to walk and be quiet. But
I Decouple is great. That.
Chris is just a wonderful interviewer. And, you know, and Jordan Peterson, you know, he's got some incredible guests. And sometimes I listen to Joe Rogan.
It just really depends on the guest.
But I don't listen to many podcasts, to be perfectly honest.
Oh, same. I'm the same way. I have three shows of my own, so I totally understand. Well, that kind of ends everything. Thank you again for joining me today, Robert. If people want to reach out to you and or get to know more about Juice the Series, how might they go about doing so?
Well, Paige, thank you for asking. Did I mention juicetheseries.com? I hope I mentioned juicetheseries.com. All five episodes are free. It's terrific. I'm really proud of this project. As I said, my colleague Tyson Culver did a great job. I write almost exclusively on Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. We're on a piece, in fact, that I'm going to publish very soon on high voltage transmission capacity in the United States and why that matters. I'm on Twitter at Power Hungry. I'm on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn. You can't miss me.
We can't get away from you.
You can't get away from me. I'm omnipresent.
Awesome. All right. Well, that concludes this episode. So just remember, it's up to you to open the next door.
Tune in next week for another intriguing episode of Oil and Gas Industry Leaders Podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at oilandgasindustryleaders.com.